Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is your host, Paul Workus, back with Christy Kleinschmidt, who's brave enough to come back for a third visit with us. Welcome back, Christy.
Thanks, Paul. It's nice to be back. It has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been delightful to have you on. You've lived up to your great reputation, and we appreciate that. Are there any things that conflicts that you need to disclose?
I still have no conflicts of interest. So,
are you hoping to develop some?
You know, wouldn't it be great, right? Like, somebody pay you like tons of money? No, it's easier to not have to fill out the form that says you have conflicts of interest, though. So I actually think for all the talks I do, it's nice to just maintain my conflict-free status.
It's always more paperwork. And it's not a conflict, but it's a wonderful service. You want to mention the call-up program again?
Yeah, so I just want to remind everyone that there is what's called a psychiatric access line. So it is a phone line to talk to a child psychiatrist called call-up. Thank your state legislator for this, because it is funded by the state of Utah in partnership with the Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. And a live psychiatrist, 12 to 4:30, Monday through Friday. There's also an online form that you can submit if it's after hours, and you can talk to a psychiatrist and get a second opinion about whatever you would like to ask us about. We are literally sitting by the phone. And if we don't get enough people calling us, then they might not let us be here anymore. So please call us.
What a lifeline it is. What does call up stand for?
The Consultation Access Lifeline for Utah Psychiatry. We had to make a catchy name. So it took an entire afternoon of planning for that.
And so I guess if you forget that psychiatry has a silent P, you could call it call us.
Yeah. That's true.
Well,
that would even be better.
Let's talk about the pharmacologic treatment of depression. We've sort of been putting this off because I wanted to make sure that we thought about all the options beforehand. But really, that has been a great leap forward in the last couple of decades, has it not?
Yeah, I mean, just the evolution of the SSRIs and the SNRIs and the fact that they actually have efficacy for use in adolescent depression is huge, right? I don't know. That everybody realizes that the tricyclics really did not show any difference from placebo. It was poor studies, but in children and adolescents. And so the fact that now we have medicines that we have studied that are FDA approved for use in kids and that actually do get kids to improvement or remission is just like earth shattering.
And the good news is we've sort of repurposed the tricyclics and found things for them to do, not the things that we thought they did a long time ago, but we've found a place on the shelf for them. But the medications that we use have much better, much more robust evidence for their use.
Definitely. And way fewer side effects, which is nice as well.
Yeah. So who needs medication?
You know, so certainly if you are looking at, you know, an adolescent who has moderate to severe depression, and so that would be using your screener, which I would recommend a PHQA, that they kind of come up in that moderate to severe range, or someone whose function is just so severely impacted by their depression, that is who I would recommend doing medications with therapy as well. The combo is always better than either one by itself, but so moderate to severe depression in teenagers. And then in your younger kids, therapy is always the first line, but if therapy is just getting nowhere and the functioning is getting worse and worse, or if you have a family that just hasn't been able to get themselves to therapy and you just don't have a lot of hope that that's going to be a viable treatment for them, then considering medications for them would be appropriate as well.
It has seemed to me sometimes too, that sometimes adding medication makes people do better in therapy. I think it knocks down some of the obstacles for some people and allows them to participate better.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that, you know, therapists certainly don't prescribe medications, but we'll sometimes get referrals from therapists that just say, hey, like we have reached a plateau in therapy, or their anxiety or their depression is just so bad we're just not getting the benefit that we need to, and adding some therapy can get those symptoms just enough improved that they can start participating in a more meaningful way.
Who shouldn't be put on medication?
I mean, certainly, gosh, I'd hesitate, like less than 6-year-olds for sure, because we don't have any FDA approved SSRIs for less than that. I don't have a lot of other good answers for that. I certainly think if somebody has depression and they're struggling and you know, you've done, you know, all the things and they're, you know, much worse, I think considering medication for them is appropriate.
Do we have much information about long-term effects of SSRIs? Should people be afraid of side effects?
You know, I wish we had better long-term evidence. I think, you know, what we do know is that kids who have depression that remain untreated, you know, their trajectory in life is just not as good as it would be if their depression had been treated at an earlier age. You know, we don't see a lot of short-term side effects that make me worry that we have long-term side effects from the SSRIs. So, you know, overall, pretty safe medication. You know, at least what we've seen over time is that we don't see a lot of adverse, you know, events from like long-term medication with the SSRIs. And I think the alternative of leaving kids untreated is just, you know, when we have evidence-based therapies is just a worse alternative to consider too.
And, you know, in response to people's frequent questions, there does not seem to be an abuse or addiction potential.
No, not at all. I think the hardest part, right? And I have this conversation. I just had this conversation with a teenager last week. Some of the half-lives are short enough that if they miss a dose, they do feel worse. And so it can feel like they're dependent on the medication. And trying to have that nuanced conversation of like, until we get you treated to remission, you probably are going to be a little bit sensitive to blood fluctuations in your serum level. I mean, I don't say that to teenagers, right? But explain it in an appropriate way. You're probably, you know, pretty sensitive to those fluctuations. And then also you're having potentially some withdrawal effects too of just not having the SSRI. What we recommend is that we treat to remission. We keep you on for 6 to 12 months longer. And then we can try to taper you off of it. It's not something I tell most kids I treat, like, this is not something that I anticipate that you're going to be on for the rest of your life. This is a short term, meaning at least just entire school year worth of treatment that we're going to do to get you feeling better.
And parents sometimes ask, so if we're messing with their serotonin, will that damage their ability to have appropriate serotonin levels in the future?
Yeah. And I mean, it's a great question. And for all we know, no, it does not, right? You know, when you develop anxiety or depression, your sensitivity of your serotonin receptors in your brain gets out of whack. And so really the SSRIs just kind of help your brain re-regulate its ability to use serotonin effectively. And so we're kind of retraining your brain by using these medications to be able to use serotonin. And the hope is, right, once you're in remission and the depression and anxiety are no longer contributing, your brain is going to continue to function just fine.
Any updated comment on the black box warning with the SSRIs?
No, it's still there. Still got to talk about it. We have no additional, you know, studies really one way or the other. So again, you know, kind of going back to the original reason that it was started with the 9 randomized controlled trials that they reviewed, 4% of kids on meds versus 2% not, who, you know, had an increase in suicidal thoughts. And also we have seen that with the decrease in prescribing of SSRIs that came after that, we have seen an increase in suicidal ideation and potentially suicide attempts. And so, you know, I think we can infer that SSRIs are effective for depression, not treating depression increases our suicide rates. And so, you know, I think just having a frank conversation with families and just paying attention. And when they looked in this, in those trials, there weren't completed suicide. It was suicide behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the TAD study that I referenced before, the treatment of adolescent depression study, it did seem to be that the groups that got therapy at the same time as the medications didn't have that same increase in suicidal thoughts. So I kind of always, I mean, that's another reason I encourage people to get into therapy is it does sure. seem to help a little bit with that.
Sure. So how do I choose a medication?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to be FDA approved, the two that you would be escitalopram and fluoxetine. So those are the two that we have FDA approval. Fluoxetine by far and away has the most evidence for it. So, you know, if I just had to pick one medicine and that was the only medicine in my toolbox, I would pick fluoxetine. Some people don't, there's a lot of stigma with Prozac, right? Which is its brand name back in the day. And so I do still encounter families that say, nope, no Prozac, anything but Prozac, right? So then I just don't use fluoxetine. I also think it does have a pretty long length of action. And so, you know, if you're worried about the family history of bipolar and you think somebody might get, you know, switched to a manic episode or potentially it can cause a little bit of activation, you know, you might pick a one that has a shorter half-life at that point. But I use fluoxetine pretty much first line for everything that I treat.
And how do you approach the dosage?
Yeah. So I tend to be, one more quick remark about how to choose a medicine. Sure. I will stray from that if someone else in the family has done well on a different SSRI, right? So like if mom has done, you know, terrifically on sertraline, then great, I'll use sertraline. It's FDA approved for OCD. So, you know, at least it's been studied in kids. Or, you know, if brother really did well on citalopram, then I might go with that one instead. So I think, you know, I've often over the years gotten asked questions about like, well, how do I know which one is exactly right? And I really would just like pediatricians to just be comfortable with one of them. Like, I think ideally it's one of the, you know, ones that has evidence, but just get pretty comfortable with one or two and feel good about how you're prescribing them. And it's more just who likes which medicine better is how psychiatrists decide. And then your question about dosing. So I typically, you know, take the approach of starting low, going slow, but going, right?
Are there big differences across the board? So it seems like some of the medications cap at a lower level than others. It seems like there's more therapeutic breadth than some, or am I misreading that?
No, you're completely true. Like there is, so escitalopram, right, has been studied up to a dose of 20 milligrams. Occasionally we'll go up to 30. I think there's some concern that it might have the same QT prolongation that citalopram has, right? And so that's capped at a dose of 40. And then, yeah, fluoxetine and sertraline have a much broader dosage range. I typically will approach things, you know, the younger the kid, the smaller the dose. And I just kind of look at what the FDA dosing recommendation is. And I usually start about half of that. And then as an initial trial, right, I think the worst thing I want to do is start somebody on a med that's going to give them a side effect and they're going to be scared of taking medicines forever. And so sometimes I'll just do a test dose. I'm like, you know what, we're going to start with this 5 milligrams of fluoxetine. You're going to take it for 4 days. And if that feels fine to you, go up to 10, right? Because that would be my normal starting dose for, you know, a reasonably sized like adolescent.
Sure.
And then, but then I just make sure, okay, we're not going to just sit at 10 forever. We're going to reevaluate every, like, you know, at 2 weeks, we're going to make sure you're tolerating it okay. 4 weeks, if you haven't had a response, we're going to increase the dose. And we're just going to make sure that we stay in touch and we, you know, want to make sure you're improving. And if you're not improving, I need to know so we can change the medicine or increase the dose for you.
What are the most common side effects that would make you go slower or back off?
Yeah. So certainly activation, right? So kids that just get kind of a little bit more agitated or just a little bit like psychomotor agitation, I would probably back off the dose from that. That is something you can sometimes treat through. It's different than mania. I haven't encountered it all that commonly, although I did attend grand rounds that the pediatrics group had a few, like a month ago or so, that had Dr. Moak from Cincinnati, and he made me think that it maybe is more common than I had anticipated it was, but I haven't seen it as often, and I give guidance about that. Certainly, you know, nausea or headache, I'll usually treat through that. Sometimes I'll change the timing of the dosing. Sleep difficulties, like if it's pretty consistently causing insomnia, then I probably would switch to a different medication. And then certainly if you're seeing an increase in suicidal thoughts, I would stop that medication. But that wouldn't preclude me from trying a different one, right? Because just because there's an increase in suicidal thoughts with one, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen with another one. But the next one, I probably start at a lower dose than I would typically start initially.
How many increases make sense with a medication before you give up?
You know, I typically will treat until I get to the effective dose of the studies that have shown efficacy, right? And so if they're not suffering side effects and I haven't got to what, you know, at least studies have shown to be an effective dose, like what they've done for their trials, then I'll still push the dose until I get there. That said, if there's absolutely no improvement at all whatsoever on like a reasonable dose, not like a tiny baby dose, but a reasonable dose at like 4 weeks. Sometimes just to try to preserve hopefulness, right? I'll just switch because, you know, placebo response is pretty powerful in kids. And I'm not saying that the effectiveness is because of the placebo, but if they don't feel even just the tiniest bit better after a month on a medication, it certainly is reasonable if it's a good dose to consider switching to something else.
And how do you switch?
Yeah. So again, there's not great evidence about this. It's like, I feel like that should be the disclaimer on all of like psychiatric podcasts for teenagers. But, you know, I think about half-life and so if it's fluoxetine, right, like that stays in your system forever. So if you have somebody on fluoxetine, you can actually just stop it and start your new one, start at a lower dose, knowing that your fluoxetine is going to decrease over time, and then work up on the next dose that you're on the next medication dose. For the other ones, I tend to kind of halvesies it, right? So I kind of start at what I would typically start the new one, and then go down by, you know, half or, you know, a quarter, and then kind of titrate that over 4 weeks or so.
Do you overlap them during that time?
I do overlap them. I if they haven't had a side effect that makes me just want to stop it, I will try to sort of slowly shift from one to the other, overlapping them over time. Because if they have some benefit from the SSRI, I just don't want to drop their plasma levels down too quickly and then leave them sort of uncovered with any medication. And certainly I will always counsel about serotonin syndrome just when you're using multiple serotonergic agents. But you know, if you're going down and going up, my guess is the doses you're using are pretty equivalent, that they're not going to cause that.
And how long would you keep somebody on medications usually?
So treat to remission and then keep them on for another 6 to 12 months and then sort of reassess at that point.
And then stay in touch.
Yeah. I think there's really not great recommendations for how, like for kids who have to stay on sort of chronic therapy or not. For adults, if you've had 3 depressive episodes or more in your lifetime, it really does make sense to just be on an antidepressant, because every time you have a relapse, it just tends to get a little harder to treat. But for kids, we just don't have that same evidence. So I think, you know, treat till 12 months. I mean, if it's like right when they're going off to college or right when there's a huge life change, you might want to treat a little bit longer. And then I'll usually just slowly taper over time and make sure they tolerate it. Mm-hmm.
I've usually tried not to take people off in the dead of winter too.
So. Yeah, right. I mean, it is hard, right, with kids though, because I mean, there's always something. So trying to decide like when is a good time to taper off of medication can be its own challenge.
Do some people need different medications at different stages of their life?
I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I do think like medicines can just sometimes, you know, be effective at one point, and then when they try it again, it just, their brain just doesn't seem to respond to it in the same way. So I think at that point, kind of trying something new isn't a bad idea.
But to go back to what you said a minute ago, if someone is having a second episode, would you usually go back to the same medication you used for the first episode?
Yeah, if they were completely off of the medicine and they'd had a good response, I would try the same thing again.
And are there any medications, when we talked to Dr. Kendrick a couple of months ago, he talked about use of medications for acute anxiety episodes. Are there analogs in depression, acute depressive episodes, where you would use different medications?
No, not necessarily. I think, you know, the only thing I think about in that case is just, you know, also trying to get the sleep under control, right? Like if there's some significant insomnia with, you know, your kiddo that you're seeing with depression, and, you know, you've reviewed sleep hygiene and they're doing all the right things and they're not on their devices, I will sometimes start in sort of acute sleep medication just in the short term to try to get them sleeping, to just help them maybe start to feel better a little bit quicker.
What are you most likely to use then?
So, I mean, I'll start with, so none of this is very evidence-based, right? So I'm just going to disclaim that right there, but or FDA approved, I should say, but I mean, certainly I'll start with melatonin, right? And then if that doesn't seem to be effective, then I usually have the hard choice of deciding between hydroxyzine, and I'll typically do that if they have some anxiety component. Trazodone, you know, certainly warning about priapism, and also just making sure that they take it early enough in the night that they're not feeling so groggy the next day. And then clonidine I'll use sometimes too, especially for like pretty impulsive kids.
What about treating comorbid conditions, anxiety, ADHD, for instance?
Super important. I think thankfully, right? Like anxiety, it's the same treatments, right? Sometimes you have to go a little lower and slower with anxious kids because they tend, I mean, even like some depressed kids who tend to have a lot of somatic symptoms with their depression, they're just so attuned to their body, right? Like they can feel every possible effect of the medication. And so I'll minimize telling them about the potential side effects and only tell the parents, and B, I just start like super low and then just go really slow with that. ADHD is pretty interesting, right? Because there is such an interplay between the two of them. I will most typically treat the depression first and then sort of reassess where the ADHD symptoms are and then treat the ADHD at that time. That said, there are occasions where I really do feel like the ADHD is the root of the depression, and it just seems almost cruel to wait any longer to try to get the ADHD under control. And at that time, I'll try. And stimulants are pretty quick to see if they're effective or not. And so in those instances, I'll do that. But yeah, I think super important to make sure you're treating everything that the kid has.
Yeah, I mean, obviously anything that increases their frustration is likely to make the depression more difficult to treat, it would seem.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it can seem, right? I mean, we really try to shy away from polypharmacy. And yet, if someone had, a thyroid disorder and they had diabetes and they had depression, they would be on three different medications for those things. And so as long as I don't have them on, four medicines just for their depression, I certainly feel more comfortable with polypharmacy if it's very well indicated for things.
Certainly not unheard of in older adolescent patients that you may find that they're already self-medicating with some other substance. I mean, I certainly see patients who are using alcohol, and it seems like even more commonly THC to treat anxiety and depression. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, such a tricky situation, right? I mean, sometimes you have these really hopeless adolescents that, the only thing that's allowed them to sleep or feel good about themselves or manage their symptoms has been the cannabis that they've decided to start using. And also we know that, while they're using, maybe they feel great. In the interim, they feel even worse than they did before they started. And also there's the potential for interaction with the medications that you want to put them on with both, the alcohol and the cannabis. I try to use some motivational interviewing techniques of just kind of trying to contrast like what they're hoping to accomplish with, what the substances are getting them in the moment. I usually want kids to at least try to be sober before I start medication because it's just not as effective, especially if they're using cannabis at the same time, it can kind of affect the effectiveness of the SSRI. Typically I'll involve parents if I need to, right? Like that's a discussion to have with the kid as well, but really to try to put together, like, how can we best support you to be sober? What do you think it's going to take? Certainly sometimes harm reduction, right? Like, okay, like instead of using every single night, like maybe it's only using like once a weekend if you're out with your friends, right? I mean, anything you can do to try to encourage them just to decrease their use.
I find that it's tough because the sort of effect that kids get from THC is so much greater, and so then they take an SSRI and they say this is doing nothing for me.
Oh yeah, no, it's such a hard approach, and we'll often get kids in day treatment that just can't seem to get themselves sober, and it almost really does take the like forced supported sobriety for them to get the perspective to see like, oh, I still was depressed when I was using pot. Like I still wasn't like going to school. My grades are still horrible. I couldn't have conversations with my families, but sometimes in the moment, so I also think like not shying away from referring them to higher levels of care if it just doesn't seem like they can get sober, because it's just not going to make things better.
Yeah. Trying to persuade kids that oblivion is not a good alternative to depression.
Yeah. And there are good therapists out there that, do specialize in, substance use disorders and adolescents, right? And so I think trying to connect them with someone who does a good job with motivational interviewing and can sort of, I think it's a different type of therapist that can tolerate the substance use and help kids work through it, as opposed to, the abstinence only approach, which of course is what we'd like, but right, sometimes isn't as effective, right? You kind of have to walk with them through the journey and kind of go where they are.
Yeah. No, and I think it's definitely something where we can still use our our leverage as pediatricians to be supportive with the family, supportive with parents, but also to recognize that this is something that may go beyond our ability to treat this thing, but we're still there for all the other stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I did go to an institute this past year at our Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Conference about cannabis use. And a lot of the programs, I mean, they really encourage abstinence and they'll still start treatments. It's probably not as effective, right? Like your SSRI is just not going to work as well if you have a bunch of cannabis, you know, floating around in your brain. Mm-hmm. But if they're just not getting sober, it's also not a great reason to just let them wallow in their depression for a long time either.
Yeah. And going back to what you said earlier, I don't need to necessarily feel either foolish or guilty if I don't have facility with 8 different SSRIs, that if I can get pretty good facility with 2 or 3, I'm doing okay.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's really all I would expect most people to try, right? Like try one SSRI, give it a good go. If it doesn't, you know, if it's not doing what you want it to, try a second SSRI. If that doesn't seem to be effective, switch class, go to an SNRI. If you feel comfortable, right, that would be duloxetine or venlafaxine. And then at that point, refer away, because that's treatment-resistant depression at that point, and that is the realm of psychiatry and not pediatricians anymore.
And if I needed to talk to a psychiatrist, I could call the call-up program.
You could.
Or if I forget that psychiatry starts with a P, I could call the call-us program. It's the same number, which is
801-587-3636. And I do want to warn people, you do have to give us just a couple demographic information about yourself, but then you are connected right away to the child psychiatrist. And you can ask us any question you want.
I have actually found that that's true. You guys have been extremely helpful. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure that people will have questions. Please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com, and Dr. Kleinschmidt will give us all kinds of clarity next week. Thank you for your time. Thanks for your expertise. Thanks for the call-up program. And thanks for being willing to spend time with us the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, it's been my pleasure. This has seriously been very fun, and I'm glad you guys are doing this and happy to be on anytime.
Well, you've been as delightful as Bill. So thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for making us sound good, Elisa. Thanks for listening, Janice. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.